I'm Elmer Witt, and we're dealing with Loneliness, the Fear of Love by Eric Tanner, and Escape from Loneliness by Paul Tournier. It's a little, I don't know, a little cozier, a little less lonely in that little room we had over at Shelley's room. They felt crowded together as well. Just to tell you what I have in mind for today, and hopefully to get you ready for it, I want to start with talking about some books about loneliness in addition to the two we're talking about. Just sharing some that came to my mind that you might be interested in. And secondly, to talk about two aspects, two dimensions of what Paul Tournier is saying in his book, which we didn't get into much Tuesday when we talked. And then lastly, a little bit more explicitly, from both of the books that deal with a Christian or biblical response to loneliness and what folks can do and what some people will try to do, and maybe just some ideas about it. Starting then with some of the books that came to mind. One that I think I would have brought along had I known that I was going to be doing some sessions on loneliness is one by Clark Moustakas, Moustakas, and it's simply entitled Loneliness. I understand he was really one of the early writers in this field. There was not a lot written on it. I think it is Tanner that indicates how comparatively recently books have appeared in this field, and then of course in the last perhaps 5 or 10 years a great number of books have. John Powell, the Roman priest who many of you know, has done a number of books. The Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am, Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Love, That I Love You, and a number of others. I don't remember all of his titles. I think he's a good writer. I think he's a responsible counselor, and certainly a faithful Christian. Generally, a wide-angled lens for it is Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Life Together, because it deals with the community of the faith and has to do with not so much the isolated person as that gathered community, and I think it's really helpful. Another one that's more difficult is Eric Fromm's Escape from Freedom, which deals with it only, well, I mean, it isn't explicit, but it deals with it, I think, in a serious way from many angles, indicating that when we have the choice of being ourselves, being free from all the things that hold us back, that tend also to create our loneliness, that often we will still choose bondage rather than freedom. And therefore the need of an outside force to help, to cause, to turn, to change us, what Christians tend to talk about as conversion or being changed or being filled with the Spirit or being in Christ. Another book that I like, more popularly written, that I think is loaded with good things, is one by Martin E. Marty called You Are Promise. I think it's over in the bookstore. It just deals with the positive nature of who you are and your capabilities and possibilities of moving up. Many of the writings, and I don't know them well, and these are popular on campuses today, of Henri Nouwen. I don't even know how to pronounce his name, much less all the things he's written. It's H-E-N-R-I-N-O-U-W-E-N, I think. Is that correct, Ron? Reaching out, the whole raft of things. I think he's trying to be the Catholic Martin Marty by putting out all those books. But he's good, respected, meditative, contemplative type of person, but much of it deals with personal handling, both of self and self in distinction from the world around you. So it happens that it deals with loneliness as well. And then the other two that I had written down are popularly done by a sociologist rather than a psychologist called The Friendship Game, again by a priest, Dr. Andrew Greeley, Father Andrew Greeley, G-R-E-E-L-E-Y. I think it's probably one of the better things that I've read about friendship in any place at all, even though it was done. The Friendship Game. The subtitle is something about how we deal with the most difficult of all relationships. Something like that. It's paperback image does that, the paperback. And that's a subsidiary of some Catholic publishing house that I always forget. things then about, I don't know, how many were not here on Tuesday? Oh my, all right. Well, we might as well start over. That's good, I'm glad I remembered to ask. Let me say a little bit about loneliness and the way we were talking about it the other day before then I get into it, looking at it from the point of view of Paul Chernier. The other day we talked about what we do when we feel lonely. We indicated some of the things we tried to do individually. We're speaking about that. And then ended up talking about what the opposite of loneliness would be for us. And it had to do with comfortableness with ourselves, being at ease, and being in tune with ourselves, as well as being in some kind of meaningful connection with other people. Tanner pointed out that the two things that are needed are to be chosen and to be understood. For the negatives, not to feel chosen by anybody, to feel left out, or not to be heard, or even better yet, to be understood, that somebody might be listening, but really not understanding. Those are the two ingredients, the two feelings that are strongly behind the loneliness we're talking about. Oh, and I forgot, we made the distinction early on between aloneness or solitude that we would select to do, to be by ourselves, to have time and space. That we would call aloneness or solitude. You can choose your own names for these and you're selected. In this group, we were talking about it that way. And loneliness is something rather that we feel happens to us. We may cause it ourselves, but we tend to feel it happens to us, or it's uncomfortable and usually is related, has a feeling of pain that goes with it. I used a couple of definitions from, I think from Tanner, usually connected with emotional pain that's often akin to grief. If it's a chronic kind of loneliness, it's related to fear, usually of not obtaining a desired relationship, or the fear of losing a desired relationship. Usually the pain leads to some kind of a motivation, often a high motivation, to do something about it. But that pain is often offset by the societal norms, and that is that you don't say that you're lonely. That people tend not to admit that they're lonely. My story about that the other day was simply that if I ask people, how many of you get lonely, very few hands go up. But if I ask people, which of these do you do when you get lonely, people all choose one to do because they do get lonely. I do not mean that everybody gets lonely or that everyone is in touch with his or her loneliness, but that most people do have some sense of loneliness apart from related to our, you know, the emphasis, Tanner does that too, in our society on meekness and specialness and separateness of yourself. To be a person by itself tends to cut yourself off and at least identify yourself away from someone else. The easy abuse of that, Tanner is saying, is to be cut off in that sense. That is, as soon as you say you are unique, you have set it in contrast to all kinds of other people that you're at least compared to, if not related to. It would be easy to buy into individualism, an abuse of your uniqueness, and end up alone, even in trying to attempt a very good thing of identifying yourself and having a sense of your own value and worth. And then we talked a bit about this loneliness coming from emotional isolation as well as social isolation, the lack of an intimate relationship or the unsureness about an intimate relationship, or a sense of being at the margin of life, at the fringe, aimlessness. And the one you'd be looking for a specific person to feel close to relate to talk to be heard by, to be understood by, and the other you'd be looking for more of a network of people to be connected to, that I'm not all alone in this, there are others, even though I don't know them well, that are similar to that. And added to that, on the part of Tanner and of Tournier too, an existential loneliness in which people would indicate that they are alone because they don't really have any connection with life beyond themselves or in a sense of a goal or a sense of meaning or a sense of belonging to God. Tournier spends a good deal of time talking about the transcendent, the sense of the presence of God and the absence of that sense of presence of God or the struggle with it is also a possible contributor to a sense of loneliness. To feel distance from God can contribute to the cut apartness and loneliness. In fact, in some ways, sin by itself is image in the scriptures as cut off. God connecting us, reconnecting us to self, creation, and others, reconnecting us, regenerating us, and our disconnection, our cut into pieces, being the part of being described as sin, distancing ourselves from God, breaking the relationship, and from one another as well as from ourselves as well. So a good sense of the transcendent. Again, I illustrate from my experience at a university where I am CAPS pastor and sometimes teach, that the word transcendent there is a much more acceptable word than it tends to be elsewhere. Most people say, oh, I don't know really what you're talking about. I'm amazed that people at the university tend to say, yeah, I understand what that's about. That makes some sense to me. Often because they're not willing yet to identify it with a personal God or a commitment to an understanding of God, they do deal with the transcendent. Well, Trinier uses that phrase, and for him, of course, it is the God that we know in Jesus Christ, but that's a general kind of understanding of a need of ours to have something beyond us, that reach into the utmost, the other out there, or the ultimate being, if you will. That being cut off seems to me cuts for us too. Looking at the other side, when the community of the faith creates that sense of closeness, both to God and to one another, that's part of the battle against the loneliness. That the healing of our own cut apartness from ourselves, or the pieces that we seem to have, that the church is offering in Jesus Christ, is also the antidote to that aloneness. Not by itself. You could have a sense of oneness with God and yet feel cut off from everybody else. There's more to it, usually, but that sense is very strong in Trinier's book. Two more things from Trinier, and then I'll do a biblical thing and try to get us for about a half hour of discussion. All of a sudden, in the middle of a section in Trinier, in terms of the page, he says that the greatest obstacle to our sense of closeness, or community, or fellowship with others, or with one another, is simply our secrets. If you read that section, he means by that, things that we hide from others and even sometimes from our own selves. A sense of remorse that we've been nurturing and nourishing perhaps over a long period of time, maybe from childhood, although he doesn't say only that. Secret fears, things that we're afraid of that we don't tell others about, things that we don't perhaps even necessarily identify aloud to ourselves, that we really are afraid of, and in many instances, perhaps, that we haven't figured out fairly clearly. Disgust over things that we have experienced, or done, or have had done to us, secretly hidden away. Inner doubts that keep coming back of our own selves, as well as of others or life itself. Jealousy. Spends a long section in another chapter on that as well, as one of the most rampant causes of loneliness. Hidden from ourselves, so that we don't live in your arms, make the connection between that and the other. And I'll say more about that in the chapter when I talk a little more now about just demands. But the jealousy that that says somebody else has something I want or need or should have, and it's connected with this just demand. Long chapter. Hidden anger.
I agree with the
secret anger.
This is not an issue in the automobile. The automobile industry, at least Ford Motor,
it's still not very popular to be angry. So my guess is, my experience in the church is still good. Or fairly normal. I don't hear many sermons encouraging us to be angry. As a normal response and emotion, scriptures say Jesus Christ was angry, specific word, Greek word, three times. If you claim it's a sin, then you're going to have to deal with Jesus Christ about that. But the scripture says, what you're going to do with your anger, don't let it turn into sin. Don't let it destroy either you or someone else. Scripture is quite explicit about that. Just as a great gift of money can be used one way or another. Or an emotion of joy. I've seen people harmed by joy as well. Perhaps you have.
Really.
Clobber people. Well, overwhelming other people who are sad at the moment with joy. The eager people, the kind of person who's like this and isn't sensitive to the person who is down at the moment. That's an abuse of a gift. You know, because you're unsensitive to the other person. And a feeling of anger, that response to what's going on. So much so that we often don't get angry about the things we ought to be angry about. The injustice in our own lives and with other people, that we don't even get bothered by what's gone wrong. And we tend to smooth it out. Comes close to what I think we said, I remember what we said, but it wasn't in this session, where Christian love is equated with being nice. Now, I know the word nice means lots of things to lots of people in different ways. I don't think it is what Christian kindness is about, or patience or sensitivity. For me, niceness means coming out bland, so that nothing will really be known or noticed, and it all just gets like that. Which sort of assumes that everybody is like that, or that nobody has ups and downs. And the immediate thing is that anybody who does have an up or a down feels, geez, I'm not normal. I'm not nice. Well, my experience teaches me that no one is nice in that sense. But so many congregations, out of my own experience, I'm not talking about yours, you have to talk about yours, are hell-bent on being nice. I think it's quite distant from the Christian faith and very harmful, contributing generously to the bank accounts, social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors, whoever is picking up the tab for people who are being wrung because they think they ought to be nice the way other people are. The opposite of nice for me isn't, evil, naughty, or something like that, but direct and honest and reflective of where you are with a concern for the other people. That if I'm up and you're down, my upness doesn't have any more value than your downness. And for quite a while, why don't you be up? Especially if we experience the same thing. Illustration, I think. Somebody who has had that, I've had this experience, so somebody else has to tell me if you've had it. That often a couple that experience the death of a child end up in a divorce. Often because the man, the male, comes out, quote, comes out of the experience faster than the woman does. And then says, well, I went through the same thing that you did. Why don't you get over it? It might take as much as, they tell me, 6 years. For a woman to survive the death of a child. And the man may well do it 3 months, 6 months, for whatever reasons. I'm not trying to say one's good and one's bad by any means. But the same kind of experience, and expecting each other to be at the same point. because that's part of that niceness that we would like to be like, rather than to allow people to be where they are. Came out of anger, the ability to express it, to deal with it, let people see it and know that it is a power that we use against ourselves and with others, and therefore has to be handled with great care. And the last of the secrets that Trinier mentions is our naive daydreams. Fantasy and daydreams, I think, are terribly important. As friends of mine say, the only time you're in trouble with those is when you don't know that you're having them. Priest taught us to one of our things at the university. It's such a great case for the importance of fantasy in our life. They have time to dream and spend it out. And it was a good discussion, but afterwards at lunch, I said, that's neat to say, but where in the world does the church teach us to fantasize, or to daydream, or to imagine? We tend to be so locked into just the opposite. I have to confess my own background in the Missouri Synod, former member of the Missouri Synod, that we don't have much time, much room for fancy in that history. It was lockstep, and exact words had to be used. Often exact phrases, often exact sentences. And the imaging and dreams and pictures of both the scriptures of the Old Testament and New were just really not very well done. And we weren't led to dream what life might be about, what it might be like. The naive daydreams that we hang on to as secrets that we secretly still want, and haven't grown up with them, or let them grow up with us, is what Tournier is talking about. Okay? A couple of minutes on the chapter on just demands. He talks about, probably should put that context around it. In his book, for those of you who haven't had contact with it, he talks about a number of things contributing to loneliness. He thought the parliamentary spirit, it means treating one another as if we were all representatives in the government and were related to each other by committees and votes. He even sensed families moving in that direction, so that, rather than being humanly, personally, intimately related to one another, we were doing it by terms of roles and duties and this and that, the other thing, so that it almost imitated in an obviously less obvious way, as if it had been organized for government. And he does, I think, a pretty good case about that. Maybe more true, if you recall, this book, you may not recall because you weren't here Tuesday, was written in 1948, and some things have happened with all of that too. But he spoke of, for his experience in Geneva, Switzerland, but also did some parallel stuff for the United States. Then the spirit of independence, the separateness, being my own person alone, he felt, contributes to loneliness. The spirit of possessiveness, as if we possess ourselves or others, rather than this period, the sense of sharing and givingness. And then the spirit of just demands. That's a chapter I want to say a few words about now. And then he ends up with the spirit of what he calls fellowship or relatedness. In spirit of just demands, I wobbled back and forth, and I suppose that Trinier were right today, he perhaps would write it differently. Because on the one hand, he's saying, why are you griping all the time? Why are you grunching about all the things that are going wrong? Because the more you do that, the more you're going to create things that are wrong. And I'll come back in a moment and say, I think there's a great deal of truth in that. But at the same time, it sounded like one could read that very well and say, well, I really don't have a right to, again, the feelings that we were talking about before, or I don't have a right to cry out against injustice. Well, he carefully takes care of that, like in a paragraph, but after spending about 8 pages on the other, it sounds like it's tilted way in the other direction. What are you saying? That the more we, can I use the word bitch, complain, whatever it is, that word that we would use to see how bad things are, the gee, ain't it awful syndrome that we get into so much of the time. I had a lovely part of the trip up on the lake the other day when I came back, overhearing a gee, ain't it awful conversation. I wish I'd had a tape recorder. It was a classic example about how terrible everything was.
And we did it enjoying how terrible everything was. It was an immensely satisfying conversation that two people were having next to me on the boat about how awful everything was. And the awfuler it was, the better it was. Delightful kind of thing. Well, he's talking more about not only looking at it out there, but isn't it awful about me? Isn't it awful what I can't do? Isn't it awful what's happened to me? Isn't it awful? Isn't it awful? The whole kind of an outlook that tears down the possibility of self and very likely contributes, according to Tournier's contentions, to tearing down the possibility of healthy, positive relationships. The outlook of seeing the worst and hanging on to the worst. Of remembering our sins, or talking about our profession, preaching better about sin than about grace. I confess, much easier. I'm better at it. I mean, sinning and being filled with grace or being aware of grace. Easier to be creative, imaginative about it, and often more time spent on it, rather than the other way around. I guess I have to voice a private complaint of mine. I hear people talking a lot of times about people who are seeking to earn their way to heaven. I'm not sure I ever met anybody. Maybe, I don't know. But man, have I met people who are in despair and who are hanging on the ropes and who really don't believe they're worth anything. Now, the one who's earning their way, we keep saying, ought to be shaped up and clobbered a little bit so they back towards recognizing what they need. But if it's true, and I suspect that in our society it tends to be, glad to get in a good discussion about it, that it's the other way around, that people are hanging on for dear life and wishing that it would be different than it is, rather than claiming to have it all figured, then what is known and what is needed is the creative, intimate, intense, effect what verb adjectives you want, sharing of the gospel, rather than the other way around. In just demands, he says, if we keep saying, this is what we got coming to us, this is what we deserve, this is what it really ought to be, this is this, it's very possible we won't understand that the relationship is a mutual one, the both of which both of us are giving. Now, in precise, difficult situations, I think what he's saying doesn't fit. I think he was talking about a general outlook in which it does fit. That's why I said I went back and forth on that chapter. I think what he was getting at is a useful thing. I'm not sure that the chapter is that clear, because just demands, really, in terms of God's justice, related to our obedience to him, no question about our need to cry that out. But pretending that our life depends on our ability to expect from somebody else, give me my just deserts, what I have coming to me, in that I think we'd be on much, much, much shakier ground. So much about Tournier, I'd be glad to enter a little more discussion with you if you want to ask more questions about it. My response to, what do you do about it? If it's true that behind it is that need to be chosen, and to be understood, I guess that my suggestion would be that we try to be people, maybe asking the impossible, who choose others and work at trying to understand them. I think one avenue towards that is working at being trustworthy rather than predictable. That's a line from a book by Albert Vandenhuvel, a line I wish I had written, that Albert wrote a number of years ago in a publication from the World Council of Churches. I think our own trustworthiness, that people can count on us to be upfront, to be straight, to be willing to listen and hear difficult things or good things or whatever it is, and not have to color them. If yours is too good, I want to say, but did you think of? Or if yours is too bad, then play it down, whatever that may be. That's not what I mean by being trustworthy. Trustworthy means I take it as it is and move with you on it. That doesn't mean I have to be conned by everything. but I'm willing to let you be where you are. And that even though you can't figure me out all the time and know exactly what I'm going to do, that you might get to know me as someone that will be as consistent as a human can be, hearing you, and if I've chosen you, in choosing you. Or if I no longer choose you, then I'm going to let you know that I don't choose you rather than play the game or a game with it. I think that's a gift of the Spirit, and I think it comes, and it's a part of an avenue, of a process of moving towards a way out of our loneliness, and it does call for some activity on our part. It buys into what Tanner is saying in his book, that until we accept responsibility for our own acts and for the consequences, if you recall, Tanner's end product was loneliness is caused by the fear of being loved. And the way out of it, the solution is being ready to accept responsibility for understanding the consequences of our risk that we take when we reach out to somebody else, or when someone reaches out to us and we respond. The last part is not unimportant. My response to the devotion this morning and giving things was also the gift of learning how to receive gifts. How much we dodge and we'll take either compliments or presents or something, or want to equal it out. Well, you were at our house last time. Well, I paid last week, or whatever it is. And you don't want to be indebted. We want some kind of mutuality, and if somebody's always giving stuff to us. I have a very rich friend. Very rich friend. The last job he had left about 8 years ago, he was making $280,000, and he walked off the job. Because he ended up with a little piece of property, I think 13 acres, at the edge of Oak Brook Shopping Center in the city of Chicago. Well, the whole of it is, I don't know what he's worth then. Remember the church? He always wants to give me something. I've never taken a thing from him, and don't intend to. My response to him whenever he asks is, how about being a friend? Great gift. We'll work at that level. I know what would happen to him and me if I took whatever he was offering. So far, and I hope it stays that way, I don't do that. I'm not afraid to receive gifts, but in that instance, I think it would distort what's happening. So the willingness to receive and understand what happens when you receive is another part of it. It isn't that somebody is better than you when he gives you something or she gives you something. I think we often say that. I am the dependent. I'm underneath. It could be, but it ain't necessarily so. How well do we receive, especially also from our children, both wisdom as well as love? I never really understood when our kids were small how much I needed their love. I just missed it. I'm telling you. That's sad. I don't like that part of me. I mean, because I was so dumb or whatever. I just didn't know. Only now do I begin to understand how much I need that love and want it. And I think better at receiving. Not best, but better. That receiving of the gift of trustworthiness, which I think is a gift of the Spirit, comes out of that, of seeing, I think, baptism in terms of relationship, the stuff that Dan Erlegger has done. There's some good tapes back there about that. The Eucharist as relationship, as related to one another, as we will again be tomorrow morning, that it isn't just the gift of the bread and wine, but it's the gift of our togetherness in that bread and wine, as many as eat that one body, and the mutual consolation of the sisters and brothers, which has to do with relationship as well. Luther's emphasis on our being willing to give power to one another by hearing the confession of one another, confession of faith, the confession of sin, and absolving and affirming one another. All fairly decent and powerful biblical Christian teachings. And then finally, that gift of ministry, of being about something together. My relationship with the Roman Catholic Church is a result of the Augsburg Confession, the anniversary. I'm sort of tired of sitting around and talking about the Augsburg Confession. Not so sure about all how pertinent it is, but I'm terribly interested in doing something together with my Roman Catholic sisters and brothers, because I suspect that's the way we're going to get close to one another. And the possibility of ministry, seeking out the well-being of the city of God or the city of man together, is, I think, one way to come past some of the loneliness. We often don't have common experiences. Why do you feel so out of it when you come to hold it? You don't know what's going on there. One good night of this or something, or having a, you know, the thing we had last night, the nostalgia night. I feel closer to some of the people we nostalgia with last night just because we had a common experience. And perhaps it was, I think it was a ministry because we all needed to laugh a bit. But doing those things together, the commonness of our experience contributes to it. Not always easy to do, but I think it's worthwhile to go. All right, I stop. I would invite your questions, responses, ideas, whatever. I tell you, I'm terribly comfortable with silence.
So you think you'd have blown your friendship if you'd accept some sort of gift? I mean, not a gift directly to you, but to something that you stand for or enjoy. You'd be more than $1,000.
He does that. I can get that then. I'm a gift to me.
Personally?
Yes.
Well, doesn't he consider that, you know, giving a gift to something that you enjoy is a gift to you?
I think that his history and other things that I know about him so far, he's not at that point. And he's getting into the outside now, the other kinds of things that he does, I think it's happening, but I don't think it is impersonal. Uh-huh. That's where it is. That's my perception. I may be wrong. You know, been wrong fairly well in the past, but that's how we do it. Good. And I could get him to do things for others, yeah. Within limits. I mean, he's got a lot of commitments already in the giving part of it, but I'd feel very comfortable approaching him with that. And he'd feel very comfortable saying yes or no. Yeah. Lonely man, of course. I shouldn't say of course, but he is. That's why I call him. That's why we go to lunch.
Do you pay or does he?
Who picks
him? Both. Sometimes it's in his office. I mean, because of his busyness, we just, and have something brought in. Then obviously I'm not going to run out and clobber the secretary and all that business. I've seen to it that I paid it down. Sure.
Would you accept, gifts from your other friends, don't you?
Sure.
Why are you isolating him?
Because of his record and background. Yeah.
It's not because he's got a lot of money.
No, I think so. Well, I accept money from people. Why don't I give you some?
I mean, in fact, he's got a lot of money.
No, I don't think that he will. I think it's his background. I think his lot of money has affected the way he has given money to the individuals. Yes, I do believe that. Right. Because I think he has seen control. Even in the big gifts that he's given, he expects some, I don't mean the bottom line, a name on stuff. He expects some recognition.
In other words, there's strings attached.
Yeah.
And it's the strings you aren't willing to accept.
Yeah.
It's not the gift.
Yeah.
The gift you would take.
Oh, sure.
You don't want the strings.
That's right. What would happen to the relationships? The only thing I'm concerned about, not the money. I have another friend who is offering a sizable amount of money for me, and I probably will accept it. Sizable. For something that I would be involved in doing.
Uh-huh.
Right. No, I'd be great. And very comfortable there. He isn't as wealthy as the other. He owns his own company. I know it must be at least six figures.
Yeah, I'd say the problem is more yours. I think you ought to make him happy and accept it.
I appreciate your comment. I'm not influenced by it.
Okay.
He's a strong man. He's really dealing out of fear.
I think he is. Mm-hmm. In this moment, sure is. I want to stay close to him to be able to deal with that. You know, to help whatever I can. I'm not his counselor. He has a pastor and all this kind of business. But I stay close. And I talk to his pastor every once in a while about, not about this, but about him. This is between us.
In the parent-adult-child scheme, where does that compulsion to give things to other people in order to have a hold over them? Is that parent to child? Or what? It's not adult to adult,
No, it's parent to child. I think it's parent to child. Is that what you think?
Yeah,
I don't understand. I'm not a specialist in TA, but I would think that that's what it would be.
Do you think lonely people give more things, have more of a tendency? Do you think that's a way of buying attention or closeness? Or how is this fitting in, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, to lonely acceptance of gifts or the giving of them?
Well, I think one of the problems is our inability to receive gifts, that distances us at times from other people. Because we're not good at receiving, we think it, you know, it has to be worked out on a quid pro quo kind of a relationship. That's what I always see in saying that. And there is an importance of learning how to receive. And I think, you know, trying to negotiate, you know, or put strings into the strings attached to it, or negotiate it. And I'll do that if you do this. It comes out of good concern, as I said. I think that you're trying to avoid a dependent relationship. But not to be able to receive gifts, I think, is distancing ourselves from other people. I think that's what I was illustrating with parents and children. I think often we don't understand how important it is for us, not for them to make little things for us, but for to give us wisdom and love. Fabulous gifts. Why we often don't trust our kids, too, I suppose. We've had experiences where they were, you know, irresponsible child and whatever else it is. Hard for us to get to the other side. Our kids are obviously old. Yeah.
One reason I came to this class was not so much to find out how to prevent personal loneliness,
okay,
but how to help those that you know that are very lonely, mm-hmm, that are having difficulty accepting help, perhaps, or even recognizing, mm-hmm, the root of their problem. I talk on the telephone by the hour sometimes to people who call me, and I'm certainly no counselor. And I don't really know how to deal with it. All I can do is listen.
It seems to me that's pretty good.
But they aren't, I mean, I would wish that they would find some answers that they can accept and move beyond where they are. And I guess I would wish that I could help them do this, simply because they do seem to come to me because I do listen.
It's hard to, you know, hard to know what to say to that situation. Helping people to see where the roots of some of that loneliness is won't be accomplished only in the listening process, even though that's a terribly important part. But then you stop perhaps being who you are and what you are.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't know what to say to what you can do other than that. If people, as if before, the feelings that we're dealing with is not being chosen, not being understood, somehow communicating that they are chosen. If they have to always call you and don't call them, then that part of it isn't being taken care of through you. It doesn't have to be. I mean, it's not. But the other part, that you are not only listening but understanding what they're saying, then, you know, it seems to me you're making a contribution to it. And, you know, there are degrees of loneliness. I don't think there's a perfect state in which people aren't lonely. It's that we go up and down a lot. You may be helping them much more than you know. I think, often, getting them to someone who professionally can help, that it's acceptable to them and makes sense to them, might be a helpful way to do it. If it's really a crime, mm-hmm, it's a loneliness. Because people can milk that to the hilt without even much of an any intent.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying the down feeling that you take, that you help me, unintentionally help me keep going, just because you give me that much, and then I'll survive. Yes, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you could help her, him, whoever it is, say to them, well, when I feel the way you describe, I'm lonely. And then I do this, this, this to help me. Because there comes a point where talk doesn't do it all.
Yeah. I have tried that.
Oh, okay.
I've gotten that far, but it didn't go anywhere. And so I've been kind of stagnant.
I think,
good.
I think there should be a high emphasis put on lifestyles. I think that would, just as you were saying, pointing out a couple times.
Say again what you mean by that. Go ahead.
Lifestyles are change your style of living. And I would think that that would help a person as far as your loneliness is concerned.
Sometimes too, isn't it hard for us, just back to what you're speaking of, that feeling of you can't always do it for that other person. And that's sort of a hard lesson for all of us to learn, that sometimes that other person has to be doing it too.
I think it's okay to tell them that too.
Well, when my mother heard that I was coming to this meeting on loneliness, she said, you're never a lonely one. I said, oh, mother, but I am. Well, I never realized that you could ever be lonely. And I think a lot of people have a misconception about the whole subject.
My past was that I wouldn't tell anybody if I were lonely. People said, all right, fine. I don't do that anymore. I don't know, a lot of people don't ask me anymore. Better today or whatever it might be, you know. Somebody else has.
I was just going to say, don't you think a lot of times that people think that if you say you're lonely, that right away that you feel like you're, you know, you don't have a friend in the world? That doesn't necessarily mean that. Mm-hmm. It can just mean that you're in a period of not feeling close to someone or not being understood in whatever you're in at that time. Doesn't mean your whole life's crumbling.
Not at all.
Well, it seems to have a connotation with a lot of people, because you say you're lonely, it's right away, oh dear, you know, right away, how are they going to handle that? Or some of the people call. Some of the people that say they're lonely aren't in as bad of trouble as the ones who can't say that they're lonely. And like the people who don't expect you, if your friends don't expect you to be lonely, you feel like you're letting them down if you're lonely.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't tell anybody.
Especially when there's an ongoing relationship, you know, if someone is married or has children around nearby and stuff like that. Lots of the folks who have this are folks who, you know, are older and children are gone, or the aged, as we talked about, or singles who are living alone, or maybe not even living alone, lots of that, or single parents, get into much more, where the immediate nearness of somebody to help in a down period is not there. I think that's where we're seeing much more of it today, whether people are saying it or not, because I agree with you, if they're aware of it and they're talking loneliness, boy, that's a big step down the line. A lot of people just don't understand. Don't really see what that is.
I was surprised that Tanner, I think it was, who said that the greatest loneliness is found in families.
In family.
Mm-hmm. Between spouses, and
that's
between
right.
parents and children.
In marriages and in families. And with strong contention. And a lot of illustrations, a lot of Tournier's illustrations, you know, he documents a lot of that. Life, and many of those are from within marriages and families. He doesn't make the same kind of statement that Tanner does, but his illustrations certainly support what Tanner says.
Well, isn't that because the expectations are that because one is within those roles, it wouldn't happen?
Maybe. I think it's that we're not leveling with each other.
Well,
I don't think we're really letting each other know what
we're like.
Or say another way, that we are playing roles rather than being friends. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I think, again, my definition of friendship that I've been using for the last week or two is, you know, includes that openness that lets that stuff come, and that mutuality that allows for the give and take of you being up, or back and forth, or both, or whatever it may be, and that being part of the expectation that it isn't going to be even. And honesty indicating that that's the kind of thing that you can really, that can be said. That you don't have to say, gee, ain't it awful, but you can say, that's where it is at this moment, and how that affects our whole business.
I had that experience this summer. I had a relative staying with us for about 3 weeks, and then they left. And just that day they left, I just felt so lonely. And it seemed like all the people I could tell I was lonely weren't there.
Yeah.
And well, I just busied myself doing something else, but I sure would have liked to have told somebody that I was really lonely.
I sometimes was thinking before, Jay's gone. My response to the thing we did the other day is tell one other person about what it was. That's the way I usually work at it. I don't always think everybody usually does, because saying it out loud to somebody is helpful to me, and saying it to someone who counts in my life, like Jenny, is really helpful. But when she wasn't around, or I couldn't get to her because she was in a meeting or something, I pick up a phone and call somebody 40 miles away or something, who's my other friend, and I just have to. I happen to be telephone oriented anyway, I guess. But I have to, hey, Carl, I gotta say something. You know, I just gotta get out.
I think
again, it doesn't always get rid of it, but it's part of my effort.
Yes. I think telephone, the wonderful thing, I've called from Tennessee to Minneapolis and everywhere where I've been lonely, and I've had big telephone bills, but they certainly have given me a lot of help.
It's a blessing, yeah.
My husband expired not long ago.
Ah. Telephone is a gift. Yes.
That brings up the thought in my mind that I suspect would not be popular in our society, and that is that a telephone possibly is a 1980 right for people to deal with loneliness. In other words, you know, as Heath and
sure.
others are, I think we need to address that kind of technological skill or from the sense of loneliness and not from luxury. It's a need of life in our modern society, and I'm worrying from the, you know, whose other choices people are making with their social security checks, etc. But that's another place where they'll chop out.
Yeah.
If it's one of the institutions that really bothers me with their rate raises, it's the Bell telephone company.
Yeah.
I have more anger towards them as an institution than some of the other institutions, and I think we really have to maybe address that.
Yeah. And as a church, not just I write letters, and I've even gone to a hearing about some of that stuff, but even as congregations, to speak up on behalf of people who are going to be hit most by it, which often is both the poor and the aged, who are in the fixed income business, they get hit. And I think, I'm still not convinced about, I have a personal fight with the Illinois Central Railroad in our area, which has more people traveling on the Illinois Central Suburban Line than ever before, and in history, and poor government, and they're losing money. The cars they bought, we bought out of a gift from HUD, out of our own area. They didn't buy them, we did. And travel's up, prices are up, and they're losing money. I have a tough time. I really do. So I got a friend. I used to know a fellow, a friend of mine who died as a vice president of a corporation. We went around all the time. How they possibly could be losing it. But they get lots of money to hire lots of people who can prove that they're
overpaid and underworked.
Oh my. So that's an ongoing battle too. And again, the people who are getting clipped on that one are the people who want to get downtown as well, or get over to see somebody on the north side and are getting scrunched out of that because they're fixed in and come along to make that trip anymore. They gotta sit at home. Yeah. Okay. Somebody else? Sure.
Do you think Tanner was lonely?
Well, I think that he had certainly experienced loneliness. From what I read, I thought certainly that he wasn't talking about it theoretically. Do you mean, was he lonely when he wrote it or something like that?
Well, yeah, to write about it, he'd have to experience it.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think it was out of life experience, a nice feeling. Did you feel that way? I don't know if you, I assume you read it.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. Sure.
Who in the world hasn't experienced loneliness?
Mm-hmm. Some people don't feel they have not, and I wouldn't want to argue with it.
Yeah,
I
do that.
But it does mean, you know, I think there are differences of awareness of it and the kind of shape that it takes. You know, I think some people think it's the gout or my stomach or whatever else may be, and it might be what someone else would describe as loneliness. So, I mean, having to fit into a pattern about it. But those people, you know, if I would have a group of 50 people and be lonely, if one person, or two at the most, would say, well, I never get lonely, and that wouldn't be every time. So it's pretty rare that people say that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think after a while, if you work with them, you might be able to find out what it is in their life that may even maybe lonely is too. But I personally don't have to feel like, well, if you aren't lonely, you aren't normal. I don't know. I think it is a human experience.
Look at all the Western songs.
Sure.
They're all, have you ever been lonely? Solve a million, make somebody know.
The rock stuff today. It's got a lonely song over it again. Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. It's sacred stuff.
That's right.
Sure. It's ancient, it's old, and it's brand new.
Sure it is.
Sure.
The guy that cut that record ain't lonely no more.
Yeah. Well, maybe.
C.W. Lewis has written a book, I forget the name of it, on something about his loneliness after he got married and his wife died.
Oh, yeah.
I forget the name of it.
What was it?
Oh, that
Grief Observed.
Grief Observed.
Oh. Yeah, I read it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's right, Grief Observed. I have it. I read it myself. And that's a very good book.
Mm, good. Thank you for suggesting that. Like his work. Yeah.
Another issue that comes up, you alluded to it in the rich, poor concept with that gift idea.
Mm-hmm.
One concern I think I see among people who have wealth, and we could break it down nationally, internationally, but personally, is how do we help the rich, like the fellow who wants to give you something, be able to give you that gift that you are trying to help him give to you. I'm hearing you say that in a sense you're into control with him in some way.
That's right.
It's a power game.
That's what it's about.
Do it my way or else, and I don't think that's the intent, but it's coming across that way. It's probably a power struggle. And I think the power struggle gets to be a way of life with more tendency with those who have means materially. And that's really a real burning question.
In small amounts and in large amounts, I think. But I think we often buy our ways into things. I agree.
How often my dad bought me things instead of spent time with me.
That's right.
Built out of not having the time for his profession. And I see myself the same with my child.
Okay, this guy calling me a half a dozen times during a 6-week period would set it up much better for that gift. And then the gift might mean something totally different. Thanks much.